Is that still clear now? I mean, clear now to run. Okay. This afternoon, we're going to, Barbara Barton, going to interview Helen Bean at the Claremont Museum. She's a volunteer. Helen, let's go back a long way. Where were you born?
I was born in Melbourne in 1929.
Thank you. Helen, how long did you live in Melbourne before you moved to WA?
I was 7 and a half when we came to Perth from Melbourne.
Oh, will we start
where
again?
Did you live? No. Where did you live when you first came to Perth?
The first house we lived in was in McNeil Street in Peppermint Grove. My father had come about 3 months before us, and then we followed by ship, because my younger sister Janet was a baby of 3 months at the time, and we rented a house that actually belonged to the Munger family in McNeil Street.
And then you moved to where I remember you. How soon was that? Do you remember?
We temporarily moved just to the next street, to Forest Street, renting a house again, and then we moved probably about 1939, I suppose, to 39 Irvine Street, where we lived for quite a long time, until I was about 19 or 20.
Peppermint Grove was a very nice place to live in those days.
Yes, it was. It was just all big blocks and plenty of backyards and back lanes and trees, tennis courts, and the river, of course, down at the bottom of the street. No, it was a lovely place to live.
And in those days, there was a lot of playing between gardens, was there? Or out on the street?
Yes. Yes, certainly. We'd be riding across the street and playing. We had neighbours across the street who were great friends to play with. Yes, and we were free to ride our bikes or go down the back lanes wherever we liked, things you certainly wouldn't do today. We had children these days.
And did you have the old-fashioned enclosed veranda that you slept in, a sleep-out?
Yes, we did have a sleep-out on the side of the house. Meg, my second sister, and I used to sleep there in the summer. Janet, our youngest sister, was always the little one of the family, so she slept inside. But we slept out there for months, all the summer months.
It got a bit cold in the winter time.
It did, yes. I mean, the houses got a bit cold too, I suppose. Nothing like air conditioning. We had a fire in the sitting room. But that, because the houses were big and long passages. High ceilings. It must have been very cold, but I can't remember feeling cold.
I think in those days our mothers said, "Have you got your cardigan on, dear?"
Yes,
yeah, they forgot their circulation was not as quick as ours.
That's right. Yes, we were. Yeah.
And you went to school where?
I went to PLC. I started at PLC. I think when we came, I probably would have been lined up to go to St Hilda's, because I'd been to a comparative school, Corowa, in Melbourne, a Church of England school. And it would have seemed sensible that, being Anglicans, I would have gone to St Hilda's. But we moved to live right opposite PLC. So I just went into grade one, I think, and Meg went into kindergarten or the Bubs or something like that. And there we stayed for the rest of our school lives, the three of us.
There was a great continuity in those days. People didn't move around. What did your father come over to WA to do?
He was transferred with his work, which was WD and HO Wills, cigarette and tobacco manufacturers and wholesalers. And it was a fairly new building that had been built on the corner of Murray and Milligan Street for the new office of Wills. and he came to be an assistant manager in 1937, and that's where he stayed for the rest of his working life.
And did you go, you would probably have walked to school, or did you ride your bicycle to school?
I would have walked to school until I was about 11 when I got a bike. We all had to wait, because I'd had to wait till I was 11. I remember it was, I made sure that the rest of the other two sisters had to wait till they were 11 to get bikes too. And then we rode, rode everywhere on bikes. Otherwise we walked.
In those days, did you ever ride across to the sea?
We used to just swim in the sea often. Dad was very keen on swimming. But no, I don't think we rode across. We did when we were teenagers and older. Little ones we didn't. He took us in the car in the weekends. And we would swim in the river after school and that sort of thing.
In company with jellyfish.
Yes. Yes. There didn't seem to be so many in those days, though.
I think they got worse as the time went on.
Yes, we spent hours in the river going. Well, and Dad was keen on the water and sort of water sports, like swimming and crabbing with a scoop net. And we'd tie a baby's bath on a rope around our waist, put sand shoes on and paddle just knee-high to waist-height, just across Freshwater Bay, backwards and forwards, scooping up crabs and then taking them home and cooking them in the copper in the laundry.
This was down at the Peppy Grove Beach, wasn't it? Peppermint Grove
Beach. Yes, just the bottom of Irvine Street.
Oh, yes. With those wonderful Moreton Bay fig trees.
Yes, that's right.
And after school, what did you do after that?
After I left school, I went to the University of WA. It was in 1947. And I did a science degree. Majored in biology, zoology it really was. So I was 4 years there, and then having finished that, I went with two other friends from school who'd also graduated at the same time, and we decided we'd go to Melbourne. It was a big trip to get jobs there. We never entered our heads that we wouldn't get jobs. We just went to Melbourne to get jobs. And we did all get jobs. We went by ship on the Canimbla, and it was quite an expedition. And so I lived there.
And was it rough going across the bight?
Yes, I think it was. I remember more clearly in 1937 when we came to Perth, and it was very rough. And my mother was a very bad sailor. And she had a 3-month-old baby. I think she spent all the time in the cabin with Jan. And Meg and I weren't affected at all, so we were fine. But I do remember, my mother had a terrible welcome to Perth because she felt so terrible and this baby to look after. Anyway, she managed.
Travel wasn't that easy in those days, was it?
No.
So did you marry in Melbourne?
No, I married in Perth, but Graham, my husband, I met him here, and then he went to Melbourne. He'd just come out of the Navy when I met him, and he was doing it's called CRTS, Commonwealth Reconstruction Training Scheme, that provided further education for ex-servicemen. And he had done his first year of an arts degree before he went into the Navy. And he also had played the cello in his teenage years before he went into the Navy. And he decided when he came out that he wanted to go to the Melbourne Conservatorium and be a cellist. And anyway, a bit scans at that. And anyway, he went to the training scheme to say that's what he wanted to do. And they said, no, you can't do that. We only pay for funds for something that's going to be a proper job, not a cellist in an orchestra. They did give him some money, though, to have some lessons in Melbourne. So he decided he went to Melbourne University and finished the arts degree in economics and psychology there, and had lessons at the conservatorium on this money given to him by the CITS on his cello. So that was another reason for me going to Melbourne, because he was there. And then he was still finishing his degree part-time then, and I was working. Then we decided we'd get married, and we both came back to Perth for the wedding, just for 2 or 3 weeks, I suppose, and then went back to our jobs in Melbourne for another 2 years.
Cool.
Then he was applied for a transfer. He was working then for the Commonwealth Department of Labour and National Service, it was called. But that was really finding jobs. The Commonwealth Employment Service, really. And so within that, he applied for a transfer to Perth and got one.
Uh-huh.
After about 2.5 years.
And so is that when you started, when you moved to Claremont to live?
We came back. We lived for between 6 months or a year in a house in Fremantle, which was owned by my father-in-law, actually. And Graham worked in the CITS. And while he was there, lots of the jobs were, lots of his particular job was getting job offers from other firms, and he saw this job vacancy come across his desk for the Commonwealth Oil Refinery, COR, for a personnel officer. They'd never had one before. So he thought, oh, that's what I've been doing my training in Melbourne for. Perhaps I'll apply for it, which he did, and he got that job. So he became the personnel officer of COR, which then became BP, British Petroleum. And so then he became staff manager, and they changed the name Human Resources and goodness knows what. So that's when, so he spent the rest of his working days in BP.
Fascinating. With my brother.
Yeah, of course.
At one stage.
Yes.
Lovely. So when you, so at what point did you move to Claremont?
We decided about 6 months or a year after we'd been in Perth, living in Fremantle, we'd buy a house. And we just looked at all this area around the river is where we wanted to be, and we hardly had any money. So we decided we'd come to Claremont, and we bought this house in Goldsmith Road, which was really, it still is, right on the edge of the Claremont division. Over the next street is Nedlands, and on the lane behind our house was the boundary between Nedlands or Dalkeith and Claremont. So we were right on the edge of the forgotten end of Claremont, I think. No street trees, no proper footpaths, and it was a terrible old house. And our parents thought we were mad.
Made up roads?
Yeah, made up roads. Mm-hmm. Yes, proper roads. Mm-hmm. But no footpath. And old photos I've got, with no trees in those streets. And now it's, the most sought after area.
Yes. But there would have been lots of young families, were there around there?
No, at that time there weren't. We were the young family, soon after that I had David. And I can remember pushing him around the streets, just lovely, in the afternoon, going for a walk. No, they were all old people who'd been living there in old houses. Lots of them were weatherboard and funny old houses. And those people had been living there since they were a young couple, really, and they'd lived all their married life there. And we, these new young people who'd actually moved in.
Oh, you would.
I remember, what got us there, I think, in the beginning was Paula and Don Manser. They'd bought a house in Phillip Road, just two streets further on. And we'd gone there. I really didn't know anything about this part of Claremont. we thought, well, maybe if they've gone that far right out there, we can go too.
So we did. And was that an expensive house?
Cost £3,000 to buy that house. Oh. We ummed and ahed whether we could afford it or something. And Graham got a, because he was ex-service, he had a special ex-service housing loan. I paid something like 3.3% and return on it. Mm. It was some very, very low loan.
So it was a very good start, really.
It was really.
Did you have to do lots to the house?
Yes, we did. When we bought the house, it had three bedrooms, I suppose, and an enclosed veranda. There was a work order on it that the house had to be connected to the sewer that had recently been put down the back lane, and until then, the night guard had come to that house. And the toilet was in the workshop down in the backyard. So before we moved in, we had to link ourselves up to the sewer and build a toilet, which we built on like a thunderbox on the back of the house. I can imagine what it looked like. But that was...
So it was a weatherboard house, wasn't
no,
it?
No, it's brick.
A brick house.
Brick house that had a back veranda that was weatherboard or fibre, something. I don't think it was asbestos. It was a very strange plan of the house. The house now has got a heritage list on it, so it can't be demolished. And the people who have just recently bought it are doing wonderful things to the garden. I don't think they've done anything to the house. But the original kitchen, when the house was built in 1916, the woman who the house was built for, the neighbour told me the story, had a wooden leg with a peg leg with a metal stud thing on the bottom. So she had just this very small kitchen, really like a scullery. That was her kitchen because it was easier for her to move the stove on one side and a sink on the other and some cupboards, and opened into a very big sort of family living area. And the people who had bought it from her, and consequently we'd bought from them, they had taken the back veranda and made that the kitchen. So the kitchen was a very unusual place. It had the long, it was a big room, the part of it, the sink had been put in the new part, but it still had an archway into this little area that had the stove and what had been the sink and was now cupboards. But when we moved in, it was a very dark brown patterned linoleum on the floor there and in the big family room, and it had little imprinted sort of dots all over it, and I wonder what on earth it was. And my neighbour said that was her stud on the bottom of her wooden leg that she had. She walked around everywhere.
Like with those old spike heels
yes,
that used
yes,
to do.
Yes, that was the... God. So, yeah. Yeah, it was an interesting old house. Yes.
And did you have a good garden, or did you garden that yourselves?
At the time, when we bought the house, there was no garden because the water pipes were so rusted up and corroded that they didn't ever get any water down. It had had a tennis court on the back. The back garden had been a tennis court, but it was just about dead. There were grapevines and a fig tree and a mulberry tree, and that's about it, I think. Mm. But we planted quite a lot of trees. We first even had all the pipes renewed, so we did get some water to water the garden, and had a vegetable garden and chooks and ducks down the back. Actually, that house, which was 24 Goldsmith Road, and the house next door, which was 22, 22 has been demolished, but our house is still there, were both built in 1916, identical houses by a builder for his two daughters who were getting married, and he gave them both a house, and people said they didn't last, you know, one soul, they didn't want to live next door to their sisters forever. But the houses were right at the front because, and there was it's on top of the hill, there was a big limestone retaining wall at the back of the house. and then you walk down 8 steps from the back door to the flat back lawn where the tennis court was. And before that, in the early 1900s, that those two courts, there were our house and the house next door, which was identical, had been the Glebe Tennis Club. Had been built as this Glebe. That area up there, Goldsmith Road and Riley Road, was Glebe land from the Anglican church. And they, so they were all named after Goldsmith and Riley and Parker. They were all bishops, or Lowton was another, in the area. So they made this Glebe tennis courts. Bitumen, hard courts they were laid. And the story that we were told was that it was laid on a very hot day, and all the bitumen melted and cracked, so they never could really play tennis properly on the thing at all. But in the museum here, is a trowel that was presented to the mayor, who opened the Glebe Tennis Club up there. So forever, when we lived there, when we dig in the garden or go to make another garden bed or plant a tree, we'd find bitumen. And to start with, we wondered, what were these great black things? And then we got the story that the whole of the backyard once had been covered with bitumen.
Did you turn that back into a tennis court?
No, we didn't, because we then extended and we, encroached into the tennis court. We still had the flat back lawn, but we didn't have the tennis court.
How intriguing. And your children, where did they go to school?
Four of them all went to East Claremont Practicing School, just on the corner of the Teachers College, for 7 years, each of them, which still is an excellent little school. And they have fun.
Why was it called the Practicing School?
Because it was built originally, they just had their centenary this year, as part of the Teachers' College, as a practicing school where the Teachers' College was a resident college as well. And the trainee teachers did their teaching practice on students at this little practicing school, which was built for the purpose. And there's a little, and it's still there, a weatherboard little annex school within the practicing school called the rural school, and that was to teach them how to teach in a rural school.
You know, they had
one teacher and two or three from each grade would go into the room.
So that was probably a pretty high class school, actually.
Yeah, it was, because it was small, and yes, it was. Mm. And when mine were there, they still had the teachers coming in and standing around the classroom, watching and listening to the teachers.
Monitoring. Gosh. And then you got involved in the library.
Yes.
Through the PNC
PNC, they had a school library, which was a bookcase in the back of the Year 7 classroom, I think, with a few old crusty books in it. And a little committee of mothers and fathers decided we should do better than this. So we raised money and bought more books. And then that grew, and we thought, well, we could build a building. And we did fundraise very enthusiastically once you get onto something like this, and ended up building this asbestos, I think it was, or fibre or something, building just on Long Bay Road within the school grounds that was the library, and it was the assembly room and hall, because there was nothing like that as well. And we had a room, it was the canteen at the back. And we volunteers just ran it, and Jenny Rowland was the mother who did most of the setting it up and cataloguing the books. And then in 1976, I think it was, and I'd been a volunteer, and it was in the Whitlam times, and he was great for education and more education for older people. And he decided that they would give the volunteers some training and make them sort of not teacher librarians, but librarians with a bit of training behind them. So I went off and did a a course in crash course in librarianship, and then they had a job as the librarian, and I was there for about 12 years, till 1986. Well, my children are all long gone, but so I stayed there.
What did your kids do when they were not at school? What was the out-of-school life for children in those days? Was it as free as your childhood?
I think it probably was. It's very different from my grandchildren's out-of-school hours now, who are so organised, and there's so many classes and driven here, there and everywhere. It's non-stop. No, they used to just... coming home across the oval, John, the College Park oval, with school bags on their heads in the springtime, because the Maggies used to swoop and take their hair, school bags on top. And they used to, go to the Claremont Bars, was home from home, as soon as summer approached. They would be down there after school. I've forgotten, I think it was a penny or something to get in. And it was quite cheap. So they spent hours until 5 or 6 at the Claremont Bars, and then they'd just walk home. And they just played in the street with their neighbours, but they did have music lessons, but it seemed to encroach as much as it does now.
Yes. We didn't sort of apply the sunburn cream in the same way as they do now.
No, we didn't.
Did we wear shirts, or did the children wear shirts over their bathers?
No, all those hours
in the sun?
Wouldn't have been seen dead with the shirts on. No, and we didn't, as children ourselves. I didn't. Fortunately, I had an olive skin, which doesn't seem to have had its turn too many effects. But I remember Janet, with a very fair skin, tried to... because Meg and I would spend ages at Cottesloe or North Cottesloe Beach just baking in the sun. And I always remember when she was about 6 or 7, we all went to the beach one day, and she came home. I don't know whether she'd had some sunburn. I think you mostly put the sunburn cream on after you'd had the sunburn, really. And her back was so sore. And Mum put some cream on because it was so sore, and then put an AirTex singlet over the top of it. And of course, the AirTex dried, the AirTex singlet stuck to the ointment. And this poor little kid, and she was just a thin little kid, I always remember she just sat there. She couldn't lie down. All night she sat up in agony. And she still got that same fair skin.
I can remember being put in a carb soda bath. Because I was the same and it was just awful. Children played out without hats then, didn't they?
Well, we used to wear hats to school, but we didn't think it was for the sun. That's because the uniform said you had to wear a hat.
Your children wouldn't have... Would they have been hatty?
No.
Sunburn creamy?
No, I didn't. I don't know if they spent... they didn't go to the beach when they were teenagers. Of course, going to the Claremont Bars, it was usually 3 or 4 in the afternoon before they got there. But they certainly... No, we didn't take precautions.
No,
not like now.
Different world, wasn't it? So was there a tennis club they played at, or...? Or did the boys play footy or
hockey? No, they didn't play at a tennis club. There was a club at College Park. They didn't. They went to tennis lessons at Dalkeith's Tennis Club on Saturday mornings. What else did they do? They were very busy. they were scouts and guides. Piano lessons.
So actually Claremont provided a fairly good range of opportunities. And they then went to high schools where?
The boys went to Scotch and the girls went to PLC. And David, well, the boys, they could ride their bikes to Scotch. Quincy Drive. over the highway and under that subway. I drive. Oh my gosh! But anyway, they managed.
Not so many cars.
No, that's true. And the girls got to PLC. Those at the bus went round the bottom of Victoria Avenue, picked them up in the morning.
And you, once the children started going to school, did you go back to work or did you?
Well, I then, by that, Alison was in her last year of primary school when I got the job at the school, at Miss Claremont, as the librarian. Oh. So I was, well, it was 3 days a week. I was just there for 10 to 12 years.
Mm. You never went back to your zoology?
No, I didn't, no. I'd worked in Melbourne before I was married for a doctor there, an allergist, making extracts of allergens to treat people with. But I didn't know.
And then when did you get sucked into the museum? That was Sally. Oh,
that was Sally, and that was for the bicentennial, or 1988.
You just joined the museum in 1988, I think.
Yes.
Tell me, however did you get involved with that? Through...
Yes, I did join it in 1988. I was just looking up in the records that the Claremont Museum, the Friends of the Claremont Museum Association, started in 1984 when Sally had got the museum going. And I joined during the next couple of years when it was advertised for local people who were interested might come along. So I joined then. I was not a very active member. In 1988, Sally had decided, she was the curator at the time, that we would have this bicentennial exhibition in the room adjacent to the library, in the council chambers, up at the on the corner of Bayview Terrace and the highway. And that meant a lot of work to all the objects that we were going to display in this exhibition had to be accessioned before they could go up there. I think that is library policy. And so she needed helpers to come and get this work done before we had the exhibition. So I said, well, yes, she had known me from the days at the library at Prac School where her children were at school. So I said, yes, I'd come. I had no idea about museums or accessioning.
Did Sally Ann give you, was she properly trained for museums or did she give you some sort of training?
I think Sally got most of her training on the job. She certainly knew all about it. And I think she might have had training from the WA Museum, just in an informal way. But when I came along, she certainly gave me any training that I had. Mary Davis was here already. She'd come some months, I think, before. She'd been living in Bunbury and had worked at King Cottage there and came up and joined this museum. So she was accessioning and she knew what she was about. So they explained it all to me. I just remember one incident. It's funny how these things do stick in your mind. But now it's all second nature to me that things are labelled and they have their numbers written on them and all that sort of thing. But I had this label that I had to accession for some luggage that was on something to do with the Claremont Railway Station, had been on a case or something there. And I remember putting the details that had to be written on the label, on that label, which was the object. And because I thought, well, it's a label, that'll do. And I remember Sally, very nicely pointing out to me that I had to label the label. So now when I ever have to do with labels, I always remember that label that I wrote on.
You would not be popular.
So I learned a few things like that. And of course we did everything by hand, and then wrote all our data sheets by hand and drew pictures or illustrations of the objects in black Indian ink. And we took great care of drawing little candelabra and all the little objects we drew. They're still there in the files, but whether they're ever going to go into the archives, I don't know.
Did you have expertise in drawing?
No.
Because they were very good.
Not at all. No. But maybe those little things I could have a go at. So we did that very carefully, and it was Tuesday we came, and here it is, 2005, and I'm still here on Tuesdays. And every time something happened, I'm just trying to think, I should have looked up this date, when we became computerised, that was early 1990s, and both Mary and I said, well, we'll have to retire now because we just don't understand computers and we never will and we're too old and we're not interested and we would rather keep all our records on paper, written. Oh, no, you can learn. And they brought out a couple, a man and wife from America, whose name I've just temporarily forgotten, to get us, to teach us the mosaic format. I mean, that's a very expensive. I don't know whether the Claremont Council paid for it, but I do know that they stayed in Wynne and Ethel's apartment in Continental Court, and Wynne and Ethel went to live in their other place so that these two could work full-time here for some weeks, setting the computers up, putting the programs in, and customising it to our special museum needs. And they gave us lectures that we sat through and really didn't understand one word of what it was all about. Well, I just didn't know any computer language at all. So anyway, we started and we managed. Our little one program that we could do, we just did sync in and we could do it a bit. And we just got on top of that and got settled. And then, of course, they brought in another program that was bigger or was better and more advanced. So that meant everything we'd learned had to be relearned in a different fashion. That has gone on three or four times. I must say, in the last few years, things have been quieter.
It's like fashions, isn't it?
Yeah,
Take me back to the exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
What was that exhibition about?
It was about life in Claremont. Since the settlement of Claremont. There was one display of sporting life in Claremont, and which it had to be from objects that we have in the collection. So there were things from the football club and the bowling club and speedway and various items and certificates and things that we have here. And there was another one that was business in Claremont, shops like Drabble's and Jacobson's Pharmacy, and we didn't have Corden's Meat Cart, but Beauville's, we've got a couple of items from Beauville's pie shop, so they were all up there. And one that was, I think we called it In Home Entertainment in the Home or something like that, and we had some old 78 records, and we have the stereoscope and slides that was in it, and games and jigsaws and various things that are in the collection. And I can't remember what the other ones were, but there were four or five different exhibits around this room, and it went on for 3 weeks or so, I suppose.
Was there a good response to that?
Yes, there were. A lot of people came through. Mm. I think 1988 was a sort of busy year and people were in the mood of the bicentennial thing anyway.
Mm.
So that really went quite well. Of course, we had to man it. There always had to be somebody there and pack all this stuff up here, all these objects, take them up there and record them and bring them back again, put them back where they should be where they their permanent home was. So it was a lot of work.
So where did all the stuff come from? To the museum in order to then select for this. Collection's been growing.
Yes, it's been growing since 30 years ago when the museum started.
On the basis of somebody's house?
No, I don't think so. No, it was on the basis of just thinking we should have somewhere. People who had family homes that they were splitting up and wondering what to do with it, probably approached the council to say, do you want this? And they had no means of keeping it or didn't know how to preserve it. And I think that's what started. I'm not sure, actually, whether there was a collection of objects before the museum started.
Because the old police station had been closed for a while.
Yes, it had.
So did they take over an empty building
here? Yes, took over an empty building. And it had been empty for quite some years. It was, at the 30-year anniversary just the other day. It was Sally Ann Hasluck and David Hutchinson from the WA Museum and Geoffrey Bolton. They were the committee that the Claremont Council had asked, a sort of steering committee, to form this museum. So Sally was the driving force behind it all. Mm. And she's, a very energetic person who can really think what... She's a good straight thinker and enthusiast.
Yes,
and got everyone working.
Draws other people in. Mm. So there was a museum council or whatever they were, but then there was the Friends of the Museum. Tell me about that.
Well, the Friends of the Museum... started in 1984. Sally was still her muse. She was not employed in those days by the museum. It was a voluntary position for her. And I think she thought she needed the backing of, all these things. It's good to have a community backing behind you. So they just made a committee of interested people to get together this Association of the Friends, and so it was formed in 1984. And they've always raised money for things for the museum, like microphones and cameras and extra things that perhaps the council couldn't afford at the time. Mm. And then some way along the line, the museum was taken completely under the council's wing. So we are now another section.
An outreach section of
the town council. I mean, there's the golf course and there's the swimming pool and there's the museum. And so all our funding is... and there's a management committee that runs the museum. Councillors and somebody representing education and somebody representing the community that meet regularly to discuss policies for the museum. And so, any object that is, anything that is left for them or is brought to the museum, somebody wants to donate these gifts, they have to be looked through over by this museum committee, and they have the final say of what will be accepted and what won't be accepted. It's a safeguard, really, for the curator and the staff that everything So everything falls back on the committee eventually.
And take us back to Tuesday. Mm-hmm. Tuesday group for you started just with you and Mary. And then...
Yes.
Who else came in?
Along the way we had Paula. Do you remember Paula? Paula was a friend of Mary's. She'd been a teacher with her. And she came for quite some little time. And Mary was a very good teacher. Mary knew about it from the Bunbury days. And she was a teacher. So she had us doing the right things always.
I had another person, Leslie, somebody, a lady who had done a museum course or was studying a museum course, but she came as a volunteer. So she did some accessioning too. But we just seemed to plod on for years like this, just the two of us, really.
Just
accession, that's all we've ever done. Yes.
And then others came in. It was Marjorie.
Yes.
What did Marjorie come?
Where did Marjorie come in? Yes. Marjorie came, that was Marjorie McLean. She was a friend of the museum, and she'd been quite an active, she'd been the treasurer or the secretary, so she'd been very helpful with that. And she came, mid-1990s, I think, and she did accessioning too, and then she did photographs, and then... In the latter years, she's got together with Jenny, and they did another project, which was the histories of the people, and another section of the data sheets on local histories and the histories of the donors. So they did a lot of work on that.
So did somebody interview those donors and that?
No, it was just putting in the information into the computer. Information that they got from the donor sheets. When a donor brings something along to the museum, they fill in a form, and in a way they are sort of interviewed because they have a lot of questions to answer, and the person who's on the receiving end is usually able to ask them a few leading questions about themselves or about the objects or if it came from their parents, did they live in Claremont? Now we're very... because we are now trying to not increase the collection too much. Everything should have a Claremont provenance. So whereas before we often tended to take anything that came along, we realised we haven't got the storage space, and do we really need it? So we're being, the committee and Denise are being much more selective about what they keep.
And when did the education... section come in, just vaguely. How did that happen?
I think that happened because the museum, the schoolroom, was originally the schoolroom. I think it was thought that it would be a good idea if we could get some sort of education program, and perhaps we could have the schoolroom in there. The desks were made by some local person, and I'm not sure whether that was through the Friends donations or not, but they're quite solid Jarrah desks. And
a copy of?
Of the original sort, yes, of what would have been there. And Wynne Lucas, who was a teacher all her life and had recently retired, she took the role as Mrs. Herbert to start with, made the costume. She was a great sewer. So Mrs. Herbert was very authentically dressed in her skirts and blouse and apron and everything. And they had little aprons for the girls, students, and the boys were encouraged to wear their short jeans. I think they might have had braces or caps that they could wear. And they started that program of teaching them in a classroom as it was in the 1800s. And that would have been about 1990, I imagine that would have started.
And that was all run by volunteers.
All run by volunteers, yes. Quite a few ex-teachers were in it too. And then that started with, so they expanded not only the schoolroom, but they had the laundry, and that used to be Ethel Lucas's speciality.
Was she a teacher too?
No, she hadn't been, but she knew all about washing. And they lit the copper and boiled the copper and
scraped the soap and put it in and had the dolly and the copper going up and down. And so that they really saw what a wash day had been. So that was another little exercise that a visiting class could do. And then they, as they still do, they have game, old-fashioned games. And then the cooking in this kitchen here, lighting that wood stove, which I think still sometimes gets lit. They don't like the copper these days. Probably wouldn't be allowed to for health and insurance reasons and everything else, I think. But there's been an army of volunteers helping with the education programs because they need a lot of helpers.
Supervision.
Not to it.
And then it became sort of official then and sort of...
Yes, and so we've had, quite a...
Paid, yes, that is a
2 day a week position within the Claremont Council, the education officer. And there've been six or seven that I can remember, education officers who've taken one after the other.
I mean, it must be doing some good filling out of education, that sort of thing.
Yes, and I think they... the more preparation that goes on in the classroom before they come, the better the outcome is. So they're encouraged to have learned about what happened in the olden days before they come, and then I suppose they go back and do some more extra studies on the subject. But they seem to...
Do you know whether the education bit covers anything to do with the indigenous population?
There was a program at one stage, and a book was
written, published. What was Dan Jew?
Dan Jew was a book published by a man who spent quite a lot of time here. I think he had a grant. I don't know whether it was from the Claremont Council or Education Department or where, and researching and about the Aboriginals of this area who inhabited before we came. And it was to be used as a classroom text. A lot of work went into it, and Aboriginals were interviewed, and then we had just down behind here a mia that they had built and a bit of a bush garden, and at one stage we did have some Aboriginal elders who came and told stories to the children, so there was quite a lot of accent and interest on this. But I think it's being worked on again. Denise has just been to some, is on some committee for Indigenous relations or something with the locals.
Interesting.
Yes, but that a lot of work went into that book, and I don't know how accepted it has been within the Education Department.
There's a lot of education about our forebears or people. Yes. So I'm just going back mentally to the Tuesday group.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's been others who've come in and who've done other things, like Angela and me. Do you sort of see the support... The Tuesday groupers, for instance. I mean, is there an end to accessioning, ever?
I do wonder that sometimes. we thought that with the Pivus collection, we jokingly talked about it, we'll be with us till we die. And I really think I have almost come to the end of it, so hope I can last a little bit longer. No, I think we will keep accepting objects that have the right provenance and are needed, but we'll be more selective about what's accepted and what's not. Maybe other things might be brought into the museum to bring more people into the museum community. I mean, at one stage, I think I was writing down here about the annex, the building that we're over there, which we call the annex.
Up by the football?
No, that just here, where
the office area.
Our office area. That was built, I don't know, about 1975, 80s.
What for?
Because when the museum started, the office of the museum, the hub where it all came from, was the room where we now have the PAS system. That was the office. That was Sally Ann's office, and we also kept objects in it. And everybody, the volunteers were in there, and everything was in there together. And there was just no room. We didn't have the storeroom, but we didn't have this room where I'm sitting now. This whole building was not here, and we stored objects. We had glass showcases in the museum, with big drawers, deep drawers, Jarrah drawers underneath, and we kept objects in those. I honestly don't know.
Display drawers.
Yes, but
narrow.
But no, just big deep just drawers, deep. Like kitchen drawers, and things were put in. Mm. So storage was just impossible. There was nowhere to keep anything. So the annex was built first, and that the idea of building that was that it would be a sort of community centre, and they did have craft classes there, pottery classes were there, and they had a kiln, and where the compactus is now, when we walked through that door, that was a wire fence just to stop people walking into the, for safety reasons, into where the kiln was on. So the kiln was in that part of the room. Then the rest of the annex was divided with two sets of black curtains that we pulled across the room that way to make the far end where the kitchen is now was still the kitchen and where the staff could have lunch. The rest was, we had two huge tables like this or bigger, two of these, and I think that kitchen dresser and another very big kitchen dresser and to give a kitchen atmosphere. So that's where the classes went on, where I taught about scones and cooking, cooking of the scones went on. Everything. And then one night a week they had a brownie meeting that pushed the old tables back and the brownies met. So it was a really overworked building over there. Everything happened. All at once.
Goodness. And then they built this kitchen area.
Built this kitchen area with the storeroom on the side of it here. Mm. So the education department could spread out over here. And we went into the storeroom just in there, which made a vast difference to the whole thing. And by that time the computers had come, so that meant everything. We used to just do our work sitting around these kitchen tables.
So when did the boat shed come? More or less.
That's quite recent. I would say 95, 96, or so.
That's the original boat shed, overlaid by a new building.
Yes, bought from the the Muse House. It was just adjacent to the Claremont Yacht Club, a couple of doors up. Was the Muse House. They've demolished it now. And at the bottom of that was this boat shed where they built their boats. And they took a lot of negotiations. It was eventually moved up here with all its contents. A huge job. Mm. I think they got... I'm not quite sure. Unemployed people, you know, who were working for the Dole. We used to have quite a lot of those people helping with all sorts of jobs within the museum, clerical work as well. youth training scheme or something, yes. Getting them off.
One of those.
Yes, mm. Getting them started on various things. Yes. So, yes, we had lots of those people come and help for 2 or 3 months and then they'd finish their time and go off. So a lot of people
in fact,
have passed through.
A lot has been done on a lot of bonus hours. I mean, a lot of voluntary hours, really.
Yes, it has.
Mm. Mm. It's a great community involvement, really, isn't it? Mm.
Yes, well, yes, it is.
Mm. So we. And other things in your life are the Provost Club.
Oh, yeah, that's
Bridge,
it. Yeah,
Bridge
well,
Club? Do you
it's not,
to
it's
bridge
not Bridge Club. Club. It's I just play bridge socially. Always on a Thursday afternoon. It's the same four we've been playing for years and years. People go away and come back and we still keep going. And so we enjoy that. The bridge standard is not very high. But, well, we're much better than we used to be when we started, I'm sure. We do play with other people on other occasions, but the four seems to stay together.
It seems to me you managed to fill up your life with fairly stimulating things. Shall we stop it there?
Yes.
Because your time's running out.